Dorothy Proctor is a survivor. Dorothy is an African-Canadian and Aboriginal from the Mi'kmaq Nation who entered the prison system only 3 months after she turned 17 years of age in 1916. During the next 3.5 years of her incarceration, she was abused in the Kingston Prison for Women, sanctioned by what was then called the Penitentiary Service of Canada, where all types of drug experimentation, including, but not limited to, LSD-25, as well as electric shock therapy and sensory deprivation, was used on her against her will. Almost 3 decades later, Dorothy Proctor was courageous enough to unveil to the public the truth of these barbaric acts conducted within prison walls and with which the Canadian government was implicated. For a period of 5 years, ending in 2002, she successfully sued the Canadian government for these inhumane experiments. The following is another story that Dorothy shares with us, one that all people of color know of, that of racism and racist attacks. A few days prior to ICOPA 9, the 9th International Conference on Penal Abolition, which was held in May 2000 in Toronto, and of which Dorothy Proctor was an invited speaker, Dorothy was a victim of a racist attack in Ottawa. She defended herself. In the following, we'll hear Dorothy Proctor take us through what happened the day of the attack, as well as what happened subsequently during the legal proceedings where she was criminalized for defending herself from a drunk, racist white man.
Well, my name is Dorothy Proctor, and I was an invited guest speaker at ICOPA 9 that was held in Toronto, May 12, 2000. And I was on a panel with Dr. Giorgio Ilacqua, Lynn Moss Sharman, and Professor Hal Popinski. And we were discussing prison issues, and when it was my turn, it was, you know, my story about what happened to me in the prison experiment in the 60s. ICOPA means International Conference on Penal Abolition, and it was the 9th, and every 2 years it's held in a different country, in a different city, and this happened to be in Toronto. So I was very honored, and it was a privilege for me to attend. Anyway, while getting ready for ICOPA, I was living in Ottawa, and that's all that was on my mind. I wasn't, you know, thinking of anything other than that, and I was getting ready, so I decided to leave the house one day and go to the drugstore to get some things for my suitcase, because I'm going to be in Toronto for 3 or 4 days, and I wanted, you know, a little traveling toothpaste and traveling this and traveling that. Coming out of the drugstore, I ran into a friend of mine who's an artist, and my friend knew that I liked Coptic crosses. It's just something I just love. It's no religious significance at all. I just like the design of Coptic cross and the Celtic connection to it. So he told me that there was a photography exhibition in Sandy Hill, a section of Ottawa, and it's in the University of Ottawa area, and it's called Sandy Hill. And he said to me, you know, you really would like to go see this guy's stuff, and by the way, he's got a couple of Coptic crosses there that you might want to see. I had some more errands to take care of, and I run into people, because I do a lot of advocacy work with homeless and that, and there's no time that I'm out on the streets in Ottawa that I don't run into people that I know, and I always stop and talk to them. So I didn't go to Sandy Hill immediately after, but later on in the day I did. I got there and I got to the place where they were exhibiting, and I went in. So I spent, say, 2 hours there, and a lot of showings, you know, they have a little wine and cheese and that sort of thing. So I had a glass of white wine and, you know, and when I first went in, and then just before I left, I had another glass of white wine. So that's 2 glasses of wine in an almost 3 hour period. I liked one piece so much that I actually bought it. I couldn't take it then, because you can't, if you buy something that's being exhibited, you can't take it then. You have to wait until the exhibit is over to collect it. But they red dot it means that no one else can buy it. It's almost dark, and I was walking distance from Sandy Hill. I'm a walker, I walk everywhere. So I started to walk home, And I happened to look through the window of this cafe restaurant that happened to have a liquor license. You know, the cops made it sound like, oh, I was in a bar. Well, even if I was in a bar, what happened shouldn't have happened. But how they make it sound worse, right? So, and cops of all people, the biggest drunks in the face of the earth, you know. So, I looked through the window and the lights were on. It was just, you know, at that time of the evening where lights will go on. So the lights were on and I looked through this window and I saw a psychiatric survivor that I knew who was also an artist, but he was not in very good shape. He was struggling. And I thought, well, I better go in and say hi to him. You know, I'm going and just to see how he is and that sort of thing. So I popped in to this little place. And this place caters to students and professors and, you know, the artsy crowd, and that it's right near the university. So you're going to get those kind of people in there. And so I'm in there talking to him. And then this whole thing developed with this drunken white man who was barrel-chested man, a big, not very tall, taller than I am. I'm 5'6½". He was taller than I am. But he had a big barrel chest and he looked healthy and strong. But he was absolutely drunk. They kept serving him. So I have a problem with these people who are serving this man, and he's already drunk. I, as I said, had had 2 glasses of wine in almost 3 hours. So I'm not drunk, obviously, and plus I had 8. And he must have had race radar, because if you don't grow up around people of color, sometimes it's hard to identify a race of a person. I'm light skin, or I'm lighter, right? Depending, you know, who you know, who you don't know, you could look at me and say, well, maybe I'm Hispanic, or maybe I'm Lebanese, or maybe I'm, you know, like I've gotten it all, you know? And I find it funny because when people are trying to identify me racially, they'll say everything except African-Canadian. They almost don't want to own that, you know, that I could possibly be African-Canadian, you know? So this guy, I don't know where he was coming from, but he looked at me and he said, and he kind of, you know, looked at me and he said, what are you doing with your haircut like a nigger bitch? So now I'm getting from him, you know, it was shocking. First of all, I mean, not the word nigger is not shocking. None of that is shocking. The attack is not shocking. This stuff happens all the time. I was wondering, what are you doing with your hair cut like a nigger bitch? So that's telling me that perhaps he's not identifying me as African Canadian. He just doesn't like this haircut because a lot of, you know, black women are wearing their hair extremely short these days, you know, very, very close to the head. And I thought, well, maybe that's what he's talking about. The whole thing offended me. But I think, look, this guy is drunk. You don't engage with a drunk and you don't engage with a drunken racist. So I just ignored him, continued talking to my friend. But he wouldn't leave it alone. And he says, you know how I can tell that a nigger bitch is in the room? He said, it smells like rotten cunt. I thought, well, we've got a crazy person here and I have to move. So my friend and I moved across the restaurant to the other side of the restaurant and left him to his own demons. He was obviously a madman, right? So my friend and I are sitting down at a table. Now the evening manager was a woman. And apparently she knew this chap because she came up and said to him, his name was John. She came up to him and said, John, are you causing trouble again? Which tells me that they've had problems with this guy before, so why are they serving him? And now he's attacking me. Of course, hindsight tells me I should have just left the building, but I never thought the guy was going to, you know, continue to do what he did. So I wasn't put under that pressure right then. So we get over to the table, and the waitress comes over. So I ordered a small glass of beer to have with my friend. Then I'm going home. So I had been in the restaurant almost a half hour before I had ordered that small glass of beer. And so I said to my friend, I said, you know, I said, when we're finished, I'm going to order a taxi because I'm not too sure of this guy and he might follow me outside. So I think I'm going to order a taxi. So this is how we were talking. We were talking very low. You couldn't hear us. And I looked up and this man, John, started walking towards me across the restaurant. And as he's walking towards me, he's got eye contact with me and he's mouthing, and I have to say it out loud, but you couldn't hear it. He was mouthing, you fucking nigger bitch. there was no volume to it. He was mouthing it, but very softly, and of course I could see it, and I could hear it, because, you know, it was coming directly towards me. I was in a place where I couldn't get out. You know, I was sitting at a table, there was a window here, and then there was a table back of me. I could not have run away right then. I knew he wanted a piece of me. You didn't have to be an expert on violence. You didn't have to be an expert on racism. The guy was coming for me. He was menacing. He was stalking, and he was coming for me. And this is what he was saying to me as he was crossing the floor to me. I am never going to be beaten up by a man again in life. Okay? That's my attitude. I stood up because I figure I have more power if I'm standing. And I'm thinking, I wasn't hysterical and I wasn't drunk. Okay? So I'm thinking, I'll throw the beer in his face. That might stop him long enough so I can get out around him and get out the door. That was my thinking. I was thinking very clearly. Well, for most people it would work. I don't know. I guess when you're that drunk, nothing works. But anyway, I threw the beer in his face. His instincts were very quick. When the beer landed on him, by that time he was close. And he swung and he hit me in my forehead. Okay, after that, all I know is I went into self-defense mode and I kicked his ass. And I took the glass that the beer was in and I used that as a weapon. And I opened up his head. And he's down on the floor now. And he's pumping blood because I cut him. I was all cut up. My hands were all cut up. It was so fast and so furious. And all I know is that this man's not going to get me. I'm not going to be beaten up. I'm not going to be beaten up or killed by a man. But, you know, I've been so abused by men in my life. And if I have to take him out, I just have to take him out. Deal with the consequences later. It's not going to happen. And that's what I was thinking. But I was also in enough control of the situation that I wasn't going to do overkill. I mean, I had already taken him out. He was down on the floor. He wasn't moving. He was bleeding. He was holding his head. I wasn't going to kick him in the head or continue to, you know, wail on this guy. It was fine now, right? So now I'm very concerned about the man because I am a soft person. To hurt another human being is just not in my psyche. I will do it for self-defense. And I would do it maybe to defend somebody else, especially a child, right? But for me to hurt another human being, to be the first strike, a preemptive strike, is not in me to do. I'll walk away, I'll cry, I'll run, I'll sit on my hands, you know? So now I'm in this panic. Oh my God, this poor, you know, so this poor man, he's on the floor, he's bleeding all over the place. What have I done? I'm, you know, going against myself. So I tell the manager, the night manageress, to call the cops. And I guess I'm like hundreds of thousands of other Canadians. I mean, you call the cops. I know better. But I'm thinking this man, first of all, he needs to be contained and he needs some medical attention. And I was thinking about charging him. Hate crime or whatever. I was attacked. Well, she said to me, are you sure you want to call the cops? Because John wasn't calling for the cops. He's the one that's hurt, right? I said, yes, I'm going to call the cops. It's just unbelievable how I'd never learned. So anyway, the cops came, and one guy comes in, and I'm trying to explain. Oh, and they called an ambulance. So I'm trying to explain to this, I'm not swearing, I'm not drunk, I'm not hysterical, because remember, I threw the beer in the guy's face, so we're just looking at these two glasses of wine that I had earlier on in the day. So I'm not drunk, I'm not hysterical, I'm not stoned, I'm not abusive, I'm not swearing, I'm not hostile, I'm just simply trying to tell this police officer what had happened, why this man is on the floor, why he's bleeding, and please help him. The policeman was either he was gender biased or race biased or both. He was not cooperative with me at all. He kept telling me to shut my mouth. And I said, but Angie, you shut up, he said. And when I tried for the third time, he said, okay, you're under arrest. I said, for what? For defending myself? Now another officer came in and was talking to John, getting him up and getting him ready to go out to the ambulance. He comes back in and he says to the cop that's with me, well, this man did say he used the word nigger, but he was not very lucid. you know, like, John was not very lucid, right? If he had been driving a car, they would have arrested him for drunken driving. But for whatever reason, they took his side against me. Now, I was arrested. The story was, and I told the truth, that I threw the beer in his face. That constitutes assault. I'm the one that did the preemptive strike, you see. So I was charged with assault, and then, of course, with a weapon, with the preemptive strike with the beer, and then, of course, with the glass. These cops were very, very frightening, because I hadn't had an intimate interaction with cops in a long time. I witnessed them with other people, but me personally. And this cop, they kept saying to each other, they had this mantra, and they kept saying to each other, sticks and stones will break your bones, but glass will cut-cha! Exactly like that, over and over again. And I'm thinking, they're trying to provoke me. You know, why would you behave like this? Is very immature behavior. You're not acting like a professional. And they would go back, and they went back and forth like this. And I'm standing there, and I'm looking at these guys, and I'm thinking, holy shit, I'm in trouble. Anyway, the ambulance driver comes and looks at me, and they put a bandage around my hand. And I said, please, I want you to look at my head. I had this, I could feel it, because where John had hit me in the forehead. I said, please look at this. I said, I'm not concerned about my head. I'm concerned about my head because I have, you know, some issues. I don't want my brains rattled, right? And I was worried about post-hallucinogen perception disorder that I suffer from, and post-traumatic stress disorder that I suffer from, and those things. So I can't afford head injuries, right? They completely ignored that. And I kept saying, but this is where he hit me. You see, this is where he hit me. They completely ignored that. So just stop the blood in my hand, and I get in the cruiser. They put the cuffs on me, and I get in the cruiser, and the cop says to me, like he's clicking in, you know, on the computer, do you have a record? Yes, I said I have, but when I was a child, I was over 30 years old. Well, if you had seen this guy, you would think that he caught Bonnie and Clyde. His whole physical demeanor changed. He puffed himself up, and he was this big guy. He was, you know, he acted like he had caught some big criminal that had been eluding the police for 20 years, and boy, he was going to get, you know, a gold shield out of this one, you know? And it was amazing to watch this whole metamorphosis of this man, this young police officer, not a baby, but he was a young police officer, and his behavior towards me. You know, okay, here I was, a woman of color, who had a hate crime committed against me, who had defended herself, and a woman, okay? And also now, oh God, I have this criminal record that's over 30 years old, and when I was 17 years old. Well, he discovered gold, I guess, he thought in his mind, and he was very provocative in stuff that he said to me and how he behaved with me, and I made a decision, just shut up, Dorothy. If he asks you a question, answer, and I would. He seemed to be very annoyed that I wasn't swearing. He seemed to be very annoyed that I was a lady and I was, you know, behaving myself and I wasn't giving him any trouble. But he wanted trouble, okay? I wasn't going to give it to him. So anyway, we get to the police station and he gets me in and then he takes the cuffs off of me and I have to do the paperwork. And I have to empty my pockets. I had jeans on and I was emptying my pockets and I had this folded up little poster, you know, small poster that when you folded it, you could put it in your pocket, not a big giant poster for a wall. And it dropped on the floor as I was emptying my pockets. I was so terrified of this guy. I thought, one wrong move, this guy's going to shoot me. One wrong move, he's going to say I attacked him and he had to shoot me. I was so scared. I've never been so scared. I'm more scared of cops than I am on, you know, with some person on the street. And also, I know the truth about them. This is not paranoia. You know, I know the truth about cops. So I said to him, here I am, a grown, mature woman, 57 years old, I'm 60 now, asking this young punk permission to bend down to pick up what I had dropped on the floor. Because I was afraid that if I made some sudden moves, I was going to get hurt. He said, well, what is it? I said, it's a poster announcing a Mozart requiem at my church. He got beat red in the face. And he said to me, you go to church and you assault people? And I said, I didn't assault anyone. I defended myself. It was self-defense. I said, but the question is, can I bend down and pick this up? So he said yes, and I did, and he wanted to see it, and he looked at it, and he's making all of these faces as if to say, well, someone like you wants to go see, Mozart. He was just so annoyed that I would have these interests, that I could possibly like Mozart, that I could possibly like, that kind of culture. It was a filthy thing to witness. It was an ugly thing to be part of. Anyway, we finished that. They put me in my cage, and I'm sitting there, and they've got the video on. I've got to pee. Now, when I walked by, I saw men monitoring the videos, the cell videos. I didn't see any women there when I walked by. I've got to pee. I know there's men watching on the video while I go pee. But I had, nature calls, you got to do it. So I tried to be as careful as possible not to show myself, holding myself up. It's an awful humiliation. Finally, two detectives came. So they take me out of the cage and they take me into the interrogation room, right? And they are dealing with me like I am some mass murderer. I am very concerned about this man that I hurt. And I said to them, how is the man? What's happening? I don't know what his health issues are. I mean, he could have a stroke and that could be blamed on me and I could be charged for murder. I was very afraid of selfish reasons as well as, I cared. I have chronic bronchitis. And so they both started smoking. You can't smoke in the police stations in I don't know about here in Montreal, but you can in Ontario. And both of them were lighting up and I was coughing and choking and going on, what's wrong? And I told them, I'm coughing, thinking about it. And I told them about my problem and they continued to smoke and it was almost like they were smoking on purpose. And these were old dinosaur detectives. Say they weren't new guys. Well, new or old, wouldn't matter. So they take down my statement and my personal information. And they put me back in the cell. Now I'm called to get my mug shot and my fingerprints done. And I was left out on my own reconnaissance. And 2:00 in the morning. With instructions that I'm not to drink or not to go anywhere where they served alcohol. Now remember, I'm going to a conference in Toronto. I didn't care about you can't have a drink. I don't have a drinking problem, thank God. It does look bad on paper for the judge because the judge is saying, well, why are they saying, it makes it look like I have a problem when in fact, but I understood later on that wherever there's any kind of conflict, an environment where there's alcohol, they usually put that on the list. Okay, that's fine. I understand that. But to tell me I couldn't go any place where they were serving alcohol, where the hell do you go for dinner? I mean, I wasn't going to go to McDonald's. I wasn't going to go. I'm going to a conference where I'm going to be meeting old friends. I'm going to be interacting with some people who want to go out after the conference and have a drink. I don't have to have that drink. I can keep my promise. As a matter of fact, when I go on conferences, I don't drink anyway because I like to keep myself together and clear-headed. So I'm thinking, this is really going to curtail me. I can't go any place where they're serving alcohol. How embarrassing. I can't accept invitations. I can't go out with the crowd. I have to stay in my hotel, go to the conference. They had a wine and cheese, the opening night, the reception and everything. I wouldn't have been able to go to that. So I told my lawyer, I said, look, we got to do something about this. So anyway, between that day and the day I left for Icopa, I passed in front of a judge 3 times. One of them to get the judge to reword the document so that I could go to places where they served alcohol. So you're in the public eye, standing there, and a judge is making a decision over you. It's so bloody embarrassing. It's so demoralizing and demeaning to have to go through that when you're innocent. Never mind when you're guilty, but when you're innocent. I hadn't even gotten to a point where I could even defend myself. The court case hadn't happened yet, and now I'm in court 3 times trying to get wording on a document changed so that I could be just like all the other civilized people at the conference.
This document being the conditions.
The conditions, you see, of my release. So anyway, the language was changed, and it was so funny because how the document was changed, I don't know if the judge had a sense of humor or not, but the document was changed where I could have drank if I wanted to. because how it was worded, to paraphrase it, it said, Miss Proctor cannot drink alcohol unless it's professional reasons or something like that. It was so funny how it was worded, because I was going, the whole argument was I was going to this conference in Toronto and I was going to be around all these people, you know, and that was a professional place to be and with professional people. So it was worded like that. And I could, if I had wanted to drink, I could have drank, and they couldn't have, I mean, this is what the judge said, right? But anyway, I didn't, because I knew what it meant. And it seems that I might have a little more ethics than the people who I'm dealing with, right? I talked about it. Kim Pate had a workshop at ICOPA, and I went to her workshop. Kim Pate is the executive director of Elizabeth Fry Societies of Canada, and Kim was running a workshop, and she was telling her audience a little bit about my story, and I was sitting in her audience, and she asked me to tell it as quickly as possible, and I didn't. You know, people are always horrified when they hear stories like this, and I'm pretty credible. I mean, it's not like people disbelieve me, because unfortunately at these conferences you're preaching to the converted. So most of the people in the audience have heard these stories over and over again. It's not new. But what was unique, I guess, is that here I'm still involved with these people. It's just like I've got this mark on my head or something. You know, I can't get away from injustice. It was totally unjust what happened. Anyway, after ICOPA and I came back, now I have to, you know, face the court cases and things like that. Well, this, you think the story is bad. Well, it gets worse. The Crown was a woman. I was told by my lawyer that she was a feminist and she was very careful about stories like this, and that I would probably get a break. So I go to court. It was in the paper because I'm this woman who's suing the federal government. So, of course, now it's a big story. If it had been anybody else, it wouldn't have been in the paper, right? So the first time I go to court, I found out I don't have a friend in this Crown. This Crown, she won it. A year for me. She wanted me to go to jail for a year. She wasn't listening. She wasn't listening to the story. They hadn't interviewed this man yet. There's an organization, a little group in Ottawa called Collaborative Justice, and they tried to work it out among the people, try to work out conflict management among the people so it doesn't have to clog up the court system and things like that. So we got Collaborative Justice involved. Collaborative Justice talked to the guy. I was declared the perpetrator and he was declared the victim when the opposite was so. The guy is now sober, apologetic. Collaborative Justice worked with me, worked with him. We didn't meet, it was not necessary. We worked out something between the two of us that I gave him a book on racism, found out that the guy was had some problems anyway. And so I gave him a book on racism. And what he wanted me to do on his behalf was to pass out his pamphlets. He was he ran a little financial business out of his home. And so these were his business pamphlets. So I had agreed to pass out his pamphlets, and he had agreed to read my book. And that was it. The people had resolved the issue. So why am I still in court? Why am I still being charged? You see, we've got to go that way in this country. It's vengeance-driven. And the cops' time and the Crown's time, and they want their piece of meat. Never mind that this man apologized through Collaborative Justice to me for what he did. Never mind that we found out that this man was a bit of a bar brawler, had been most of his life. Never mind that I had written a letter of apologizing to him for wounding him, which I had no problem doing. Of course I was sorry. I'm sorry if I step on an ant. I don't want to hurt anybody, right? So I wrote my letter of regret to him, telling him that I regretted that this circumstance, you know, happened, that it turned out the way it did. And that was it. Now, as far as we were concerned in a civilized society, that should have been it. The charges should have been dropped, and that's it. Well, no, the charges were not dropped. Now, a deal was presented to me. Now, this tells me that tens of thousands of Canadians every day make a deal with the Crown, even when they're innocent, because they don't want to be involved in the system. They want to make a deal. They want to get the hell out, right? The deal was that the Crown would drop the charges to common assault and ask for probation. if I would not use the language that John had used against me in a public courtroom, because after all, he was a businessman, and we don't want to ruin his reputation. And of course I agreed, because I got this big federal case going with the federal government. I don't want to be going to court. If I had have gone to trial with this, no doubt I would have won, because I had had all the women's groups. I would have had, you know, all of those people and the black groups and, you know, all the ethnic groups and everything out there. But I wanted to finish with it. I wanted to finish with it. Anyway, we go to court. We agreed. There was a in the judges' chambers meeting with all the players except me, and this was all agreed upon. And so she wanted a year probation, and the judge gave me 6 months probation. So I was declared guilty of this, and this man got away with racially attacking me. You see, so in this country, the message is that a woman of color cannot defend herself against a drunk racist. You absolutely can't. You got to let that man beat you, kill you, do whatever he wants to you. That's the message. And, I mean, it's so multifaceted here. We have these crazy-ass cops who terrified the hell out of me, to a Crown that wants to make a deal based on, since when is it the Crown's responsibility to protect racists? I know this is a pretty lengthy story here, but that's actually the condensed version of this story. As I said, there are little details here and there, but they're not relevant, right? But cost me $4,000, money I didn't have. I had to borrow it. Cost me $4,000 to get a criminal lawyer to defend me in this bloody case. And publicly humiliated and embarrassed and upsetting, of course, to me. And I think I'm pretty reasonable. I know what's the truth. I know what's the facts. I know what's going on. I'm not saying that there are times when a member of the black race is out of control and does, behaves or acts in a way that maybe they need to be restrained or they need to be, you know, like everybody. But I just think that people of color in this country are targeted. I think the police force is racist, and I believe they're gender biased. And I believe they're homophobic. And I have had white friends say to me, and I get annoyed because I think, my God, you've been hanging around with me for years, hasn't anything rubbed off as far as information, you know? And I've had white friends say to me, oh, well, things are better now, Dorothy, because we have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I said, my dear, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms are for you. They're not for me. They're not for poor people. They're not for people of color. They're not for the mentally ill. They're not for lesbians and gays. They're not for children. They're for an elitist group. And remember who the four framers were of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. They were old, wealthy, heterosexual, white men. So how can the Charter of Rights and Freedoms be for any of us, any marginalized people, any oppressed people? They're for you. My friend that was saying this to me does come from the group I was describing, you know, the upper classes, the ruling class. Remember the ruling class, you see? So they don't know. And I mean, they can have friends like me coming out of their ears. They just don't get it. And then I hear people say, well, there's no racism. Well, if you're white and you're not an activist and you're not an advocate and you're not in different cultures other than your own, you know, of course there's no racism because you're not affected.